This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 30th, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, news from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, news from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, Sean Holman's talk at the 2018 Information Summit in Vancouver on the battle for transparency in the post-truth world. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who deserve it. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is the issue of the housing crisis smothering the Vancouver civic election discourse? Don't get me wrong, housing cannot and should not be ignored. It is that important. But it is not the be-all and end-all. The next mayor of Vancouver will also become the head of the police board. And do any of these candidates care about law and order? Because it certainly has not been a priority in Vancouver since Vision Vancouver's era began in 2008. Heck, the mayor's own foster son was jailed for being in a drugs and guns gang, and the foster son's brother was killed in a gangland hit last summer. Yet, Robertson adopted a lax attitude toward crime in the city. So, hands up if you know someone who has been a victim of crime in Vancouver, even just a break-in and theft from a parked car. The only candidate with real credibility on this issue is Vancouver First's mayoral candidate, Fred Harding, a former senior officer in the West Vancouver Police. Yet, he is not getting the attention he deserves and doesn't appear to be trying hard to get attention on social media. And then there is the rapid transit issue. UBC professor Patrick Condon was a guest on this podcast recently. He was supposed to run for mayor under the COPE banner until he was sidelined by a stroke in July. Condon is against the Broadway SkyTrain subway that goes to Arbutus that will cost more than $3 billion. For the same price, Condon said, we could get a streetcar all the way to UBC, and even more than that. In Surrey, candidates are fighting over SkyTrain and LRT. The shovels are not on the ground yet for the LRT system, so why not let the public have a say? It's their money. And this is a healthy debate. But in Vancouver, candidates are too scared to say anything bad about the Broadway subway. Meanwhile, you will be stuck with the bill. What do you think? Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In ABC News Australia, Stephanie Chalmers, Michael Janda, Andrew Robertson, and Clint Jasper report Banking Royal Commission key findings from Kenneth Hain's interim report. For the past 6 months, Kenneth Hain has been sifting through a slew of misconduct, poor behavior, and regulatory inaction. Consumer lending is the vast majority of the bank's business, with home lending the bulk of that, a whopping $1.6 trillion at the end of last year. Most concerning for the major banks, which have significantly tightened their home loan assessment procedures under the weight of Kenneth Hain's gaze, is that the commissioner is asking whether even these tougher processes still fail to satisfy the law. If the commissioner finds that they are still in breach, the banks will have to tighten access to credit even further, lowering their profits and potentially further strangling already declining housing markets. Kenneth Hain has described the financial advice industry as one riddled with dishonesty and greed. Quote, giving advice that does not serve the client's interest but profits the advisor is equally dishonest, end quote, he said in the report. In the South China Morning Post, Lori Chen reports, how a Chinese rocket scientist's resignation started a nation talking. A legal document describing how an obscure rocket scientist left his job at a Chinese aerospace company has gone viral, igniting a fierce debate over state-owned enterprises struggling to retain their talent, as well as fears of China falling behind in the global space race. Photos of the document were published in a Weibo essay by blogger Ji Zhuzhang titled, Why are talents that can directly influence China's moon landing left to languish at the bottom of state-owned enterprises? It prompted debate on social media, including open criticism of state-owned enterprises, which is rare in China, on the same day that President Xi Jinping vowed to continue to strengthen state-owned enterprises. The essay by Xi, who claims to be based in Hong Kong, said Zhang had taken up a research position at the private aerospace firm Landscape Tech, earning 10 times his previous salary of 120,000 yuan, or $17,400 per year. Landscape Tech is developing commercial forms of space travel similar to that of Elon Musk's SpaceX. In the LA Times, David Pearson reports, extra inventory, more sales, lower prices, how counterfeits benefit Amazon. The sale of fake goods is at least a $461 billion global industry and expanding, in no small part because of the rise of e-commerce giants like Amazon and China's Alibaba. There's little authorities can do apart from name and shame offenders. Alibaba's primary platform, Taobao, has repeatedly been included in the United States Trade Representative's list of notorious markets for selling counterfeits. Then there's Amazon. Not only has the platform avoided any serious backlash for allowing the sale of fake goods, it's actually thrived from it, say more than two dozen brand owners, e-commerce consultants, attorneys, investigators, and public policy experts. Sellers of fake goods pay transaction and shipping fees just like legitimate businesses, but counterfeits also helped Amazon's bottom line in other ways. Amazon obtained permission in 2015 to ship goods out of China, which allowed Chinese sellers to tap into Amazon's logistical services. Of the 1 million new sellers that joined the marketplace between 2015 and 2017, about 300,000 were from China, according to estimates. Enlisting legions of Chinese sellers provided the scale Amazon sought, but its drawbacks were predictable. China and Hong Kong are the origin of more than 80% of the world's supply of fake goods, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It's often difficult for U.S. brands to sue Chinese counterfeiters who regularly falsify the contact information they provide Amazon. Amazon said in a statement that it strictly prohibits the sale of counterfeit products. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Olympian, Abby Spegman reports, more than 100 mountain goats removed from Olympic National Park in first operation. In all, 115 mountain goats were captured. Of those, 98 mountain goats, 68 female and 30 male, were moved to the Northern Cascade Mountains. 8 mountain goats died during the capture and 3 were euthanized. 6 were moved to Northwest Trek Wildlife Park near Eatonville. Officials have long sought to remove non-native mountain goats from Olympic National Park to protect people and native plants. In May, the National Park Service announced it would remove about 725 mountain goats on the Olympic Peninsula. In the Haida Gwaii Observer, Andrew Hudson reports, restored replica Haida pole brings nations together at Peace Arch. Haida Semiamu Kwakwaka and provincial leaders joined to raise a restored replica totem pole at the Peace Arch border crossing. Carved in the 1950s by the late artist Mungo Martin, the pole is a replica of one that stood at Skidance. Originally commissioned by the Royal BC Museum, the pole went up without ceremony, and in 2008, it was removed without any notice to the three First Nations to make room for a new Peace Arch Visitor Center. At the raising of the restored pole on Friday, September 21st, BC Premier John Horgan apologized for its undignified removal. And in the Vancouver Civic election, The Breaker reported that NPA mayoral candidate Ken Sim wants to strike a task force on personal information and anonymous campaigning if he is elected. Sim was the target of an anonymous spear campaign on Facebook. He also pointed at opponent Hector Bremner of the Yes Vancouver Party. The former NPA city councillor, whose pre-election ad campaign was paid for by developer Peter Wall. Bremner said he didn't know Wall was behind the $85,000 campaign. Wall apparently is now backing independent Kennedy Stewart, the former Burnaby NDP MP. And The Breaker received a leaked copy of Mayor Gregor Robertson's undercover boss parody video. Robertson pretended he was in the reality TV show to tape the skit for the annual Civic Service Awards.
Robert Gregerson, undercover mayor.
You know anything about affordable housing?
Sure. Okay.
The video was posted for staff on September 27th, 3 weeks after the Breaker asked for it from the City Hall FOI office. Election day is October 20th. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Canada has fallen to 55th in the world rankings of the most open countries, a drop of 6 spots. The home and native land is now tied with Bulgaria and Uruguay, according to the Halifax-based Center for Law and Democracy and Access Info Europe. To mark the annual Right to Know Week, Mount Royal University professor Sean Holman was a keynote speaker at the 2018 Information Summit, hosted September 27th in Vancouver by the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association. Through pop culture references and quotes from academics and politicians, and his own observations, Holman gave a dire warning. As Canadians and Americans have become more educated, governments and corporations still have more information than citizens. Their propaganda and advertising poisons the public square and chokes off debate and dissent, Holman said. In his talk, he urged transparency advocates to promote the value of information and to teach children how to use information to make reasoned and empathetic decisions. Here is part of Sean Holman's presentation at the Information Summit.
Moreover, even when governments and corporations did provide information to the public, there was a belief that it was somehow compromised, being either incomplete or outright inaccurate. In 1961, Newton complained that over the previous 25 years, an army of approximately 50,000 government press agents, they're now known as communications people, perhaps there's some in this room today, had been raised in Washington to reflect glory upon their employers rather than tell the truth. In 1974, a Privy Council office study in Canada quietly acknowledged the same criticism in this country. It stated that the most common complaint about government communications was that it only released information which was considered advantageous or harmless and automatically withheld the rest. Nor was government alone in only releasing information that was considered advantageous or harmless. In the post-war period, there were concerns that corporations were creating false or misleading advertisements, a concern that was reflected in American and Canadian public opinion polls. All this made consumers and citizens uncertain about the information governments and corporations were providing. It also violated expectations about how politics and the economy should theoretically function in the same way government and corporate secrecy have, and that contributed to emotional and cognitive demands, again, for information. Finally, I would be remiss if I did not recognize the overall tenor of the times as heightening these demands. In the post-war period, there seems to have been a feeling in Canada and the United States that the world was uncertain and uncontrollable, in part because of the forces I've already spoken about. These feelings can be seen in some of the political polling and writing from that period, but they can perhaps most clearly be heard in post-war popular culture. The most famous example is the Mad as Hell speech from the 1976 movie Network. And if you haven't seen that movie, you really should. In that speech, which, by the way, provided the title for a book that was all about the 70s, so this is how emblematic it is of that decade, fictional news anchor Howard Beale told his audience, "We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore." As a result, Beale said, "I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. All I know is that first you've got to get mad." And if you hear echoes of that today, I think there's probably a good reason. And indeed, echoes of that despair can be heard in thrillers and satires of the 60s and 70s. We can hear it in 7 Days in May, when United States President Jordan Lyman warned that the nuclear age has killed man's faith in his ability to influence what happens to him. We can hear it in Canada, when California senatorial contender Bill McKay worries that people may lose the power to shape their own lives, which are more and more determined by forces that overwhelm the individual. And we can even hear it in the protest music of the period. For example, on his classic album, What's Going On, Marvin Gaye sings about how everything from trigger-happy policing to inflation and taxes makes him want to holler and throw out both my hands. And these feelings that the world had become more uncertain and uncontrollable resulted in demands for information, with John Lennon's 1971 double platinum-selling album, Imagine, giving voice to that desire. In one song, Lennon complains about being sick and tired of hearing things from pig-headed politicians and narrow-minded hypocrites who have tried to soft-sew him with a pocket full of hope. Instead, he pleads, "All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth." The rejection of these demands for information resulted in leaks as well as calls for transparency measures. After all, if those demands had been met, there wouldn't have been a need for whistleblowers, nor would there have been a demand for such measures, most of which were directed at government, since it was seen as the paramount source of information about both the public and private sector during the post-war period. Freedom of information laws, which were approved in 1965 in the United States and 1982 in Canada, are perhaps the ultimate example of those measures. Yet many of the forces that contributed to the creation of those measures persist today. After years of cutbacks and rollbacks, our governments may no longer be the unknowable gods Alexander once claimed they once were. However, much of their size remains. Big businesses are also getting even bigger, especially in relationship to national economies. And the abuses and potential abuses of governments and corporations remain just as frightening as they have ever been. At the same time, Americans and Canadians continue to become more and more educated, yet no matter how educated they are, governments and corporations still have more information than individuals do, thanks to the use of sophisticated surveillance, information storage, and information retrieval technologies. And they are still reluctant to share what they know. Instead, their propaganda and advertising poisons the public square, choking off debate and dissent. Yet, and this is where it gets depressing, are we still seeing the same cognitive demand for information and transparency now that we saw in the post-war period? If we aren't, I believe that may be because information does not appear to be able to purchase the kind of citizen and consumer control that we thought it would and should. As a result of partisanship, the permanent campaign, and the influence of special interests, especially big businesses, elected and non-elected government officials often seem impervious to the truth, being unable to make informed, reasoned, and empathetic decisions that are in the public interest and in the basis for democratic society. The decisions they make are then further constrained by the prevailing expectations about what government can and cannot do, which have shrunk significantly since the 80s. Even more pernicious, though, are the officials and citizens whose beliefs and behavior seem completely unmoored from reality. President Donald J. Trump is perhaps the ultimate example of such an official, but he is merely representative of large portions of the public who repeatedly fail to make decisions that are in their own long-term best interest. Nor do these portions of the public seem capable of making decisions that are in the long-term best interest of others, from family, friends, and neighbors, to fellow citizens, non-citizens, and the multitude of species living on this planet, this fragile planet we all share. It is against this backdrop that we see spectacles such as the March for Science, where the demonstrators' pleas for evidence-based decisions can perhaps more clearly be heard as pleas to empower the truth in politics. Give me some truth. Yet those pleas are so often ignored that the impotence of truth has become a punchline, with one Saturday Night Live skit mocking the idea that even an admission of guilt by Trump that he obstructed the Russia investigation wouldn't matter. As a result, the cognitive demand for information and control may be receding in favor of an emotional demand for certainty. And in this demand for certainty, we see the seduction of authoritarianism as well as the spurning of democracy. Even those who prize information's cognitive and controlling value may welcome such a change if governments would actually act in accordance with the truth. So what does this mean for anyone who cares about information, which, again, is hopefully everyone in this room? What does it mean for anyone whose career is premised on the cognitive value of information? What does it mean for anyone who uses freedom of information laws to obtain this information? It means that we should not simply be advocating for transparency. It means we should be advocating for the value of information. It means that we need to do more to teach our children how to use that information to make the reasoned and empathetic decisions that our society is supposed to be based on. And we need to do more to ensure that those decisions matter within the context of politics and the economy. Because when those decisions do not matter, information ceases to be the currency of democracy, providing a means of controlling our governments and corporations. And if we cannot control those governments and corporations, we no longer live in a democracy. That's it.
That was Sean Holman, professor of journalism from Mount Royal University in Calgary. Holman was a keynote speaker at the Information Summit in Vancouver on September 27th. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Sean Holman, the former investigative journalist who you just heard on this podcast. Holman is now a professor of journalism at Mount Royal University in Calgary and the most important voice in Canada on the ongoing battle for transparency and accountability. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 30th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on September 30th in 1947, the World Series between the New York Yankees and Brooklyn Dodgers was televised for the first time? And on September 30th in 1968, the Boeing 747 was unveiled in public at the Everett factory. Two milestones in communication and transportation history. Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Thanks to some of our supporters like Quan Lee, Randy Sogstad, James Plett, Spruce Hill Contracting, Daryl Greer, Barbara May, Elvil Chies, John Kennedy, and Dave and Burnaby. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.